Brother James, Christian forgiveness.
Thank you, Brother John, and good morning, brothers and sisters. So, when I was on to exhort today, I looked at the readings and was like, oh, Matthew 23. I really like Matthew 23. I feel like I've done an exhortation on this before. Turns out I have. If you go to the sfchristadelphian.org webpage and click on exhortations and scroll down, you'll find out that 6 years ago to the day, I was standing here and gave an exhortation on Matthew 23. So you're not going to hear that exhortation. If you want to hear it, it's on the website. But I still really like Matthew 23. And one of the things I really like about Matthew 23 is that I always find the criticisms of the Pharisees are especially poignant as a warning to me today, because the Pharisees are people who are religious people. They're people who care about God's law and who knew it really well. And those are people like us, I feel, people who know their Bibles. And so Jesus' criticisms of the Pharisees, I find, are things that often I can take to heart, because they are criticisms of people who are trying to be religious, who know what's right, and yet somehow are getting it wrong. And so, at the beginning of Matthew 23, he has this passage that in some way is sort of confusing and sort of scary, and is going to provide the springboard for my remarks this morning. And so I'm going to start reading at verse 2 of Matthew 23. The scribes and Pharisees sit on Moses' seat. So practice and observe whatever they tell you, but not what they do. For they preach, but do not practice. They tie up heavy burdens, hard to bear, and lay them on people's shoulders, but they themselves are not willing to move them with their finger. Now, how is it that you can preach something, but not practice it? And I mean, there's a few different ways that this is possible. One is, of course, I could stand up here and tell you all need to be forgiving, and then go home and not be forgiving. That's really easy to do. Many things are easier said than done. So I can stand up here and tell you something and just be lying through my teeth or choosing not to do it. That's one way to do it. There's another way to do it, though, which you might find more perhaps relevant to what was going on here with the Pharisees. And that's where you tell people something, but you also find sort of legalistic workarounds so that when you actually have to do it, you can legally find an easier way to do it that's still right. So for instance, this would be sort of like if I told you all, you need to forgive people. But then I was like, when I had a situation, was like, well, that only is the case if they don't do anything really bad. And this was really bad, so I don't need to forgive anyone. So that would be sort of finding a legalistic workaround. And if you read much about a lot of Jewish law, you find all sorts of interesting workarounds like that. But there's a third way that you can end up preaching something and not practicing it that I hadn't really thought about until I was rereading this book called Pride and Prejudice a little while ago. You may have heard of this book. For those who aren't completely familiar with it, it's a romantic novel published in 1813, so the language is a little old, and it explores a number of different romantic relationships in the British upper class of that period. In particular, there's a couple of characters that I'm going to bring out. One is named Mr. Bennet, and he's the sarcastic father of the heroine, but not the drug, the heroine of the story. And he is sarcastic and tends to make very sort of smart remarks, my favorite character in the entire book. But he gets this letter from someone named Mr. Collins, who is an Anglican priest, or Episcopalian, or whatever you call him here in the States, but priest of the Church of England. And this priest of the Church of England has a rather high opinion of himself. And so it's just this small little interaction, but let me read it to you from Pride and Prejudice. This is a letter that Mr. Collins, the Anglican priest, has written to Mr. Bennet. I am truly rejoiced that my cousin Lydia's sad business has been so well hushed up, and I'm only concerned that their living together before the marriage took place should be so generally known. I must not, however, neglect the duties of my station, or refrain from declaring my amazement at hearing that you received the young couple into your house as soon as they were married. It was an encouragement of vice, and had I been the rector of Longbourn, I should have very strenuously opposed it. You ought certainly to forgive them as a Christian, but never to admit them in your sight or allow their names to be mentioned in your hearing. And then Mr. Bennett's response is, so that is his notion of Christian forgiveness. And I've always thought that was a really powerful line. You ought certainly to forgive them as a Christian, but never to admit them in your sight or allow their names to be mentioned in your hearing. His notion of Christian forgiveness seems to be that you should forgive the person, but then not forgive them. It's like he's essentially redefined forgiveness as something that's completely meaningless, because he's saying you should forgive them and then do something that's not forgiving. And the reason I like this line so much is because Pride and Prejudice might be a work of fiction that's sort of drawing this out to make it almost satirical. But the situation he's describing, this idea of people paying lip service to the idea of forgiveness but not actually doing it, is something people do in real life as well. In fact, it's something that happens in a chapter in the Bible that is sometimes a little weird, but came out to me in a new light when I was thinking about it in this way, and that's 2 Samuel chapter 14. So I'm not going to read all of 2 Samuel 14, because it's sort of a weird chapter. But what's going on in 2 Samuel 14 is Absalom has, King David has some sons. One of them was named Amnon. Amnon was a totally terrible guy. And then his other son, Absalom, killed Amnon. And then Absalom, because he just committed murder, ran away, and the king was sort of stuck with this dilemma where he actually sort of thought what Absalom did was right, but at the same time, Absalom had done something wrong by killing his brother. And 2 Samuel 14 doesn't actually resolve the tension there in terms of whether what Absalom did was right. But what it does do is talk about this whole concept of forgiveness. It starts off with Joab realizing that King David wants to forgive Absalom, so he does this complicated thing with this widow woman who basically comes to David and gives him this whole sermon on you should forgive people. And so David calls in Joab and he's like, yeah, I hear you. Okay, Absalom can come back and be in Jerusalem, but he's not allowed to see me. So Joab comes and brings back Absalom, but Absalom, like, basically just has to stay home and has no relationship whatsoever with the king, and they ignore each other. And Absalom is not happy about this. In fact, he's an interesting character. What he ends up doing is trying to get Joab to fix it. Joab doesn't do anything, so then he burns down Joab's field. Let me read 2 Samuel 14, verse 32, after Joab is like, why did you burn down my field? 2 Samuel 14, verse 32, Absalom answered Joab, behold, I sent word to you, come here that I may send you to the king to ask, why have I come from Geshur, which is where he was exiled? It would be better for me to be there still. Now, therefore, let me go into the presence of the king, and if there is guilt in me, let him put me to death. Basically, what he's saying is that you brought me back from exile so that I could be forgiven, but there is no forgiveness here. I'm back in Jerusalem, but I don't have a relationship with the king. He's basically pretending I'm still back in Geshur, as far as he's concerned. That's not forgiveness. I'm unhappy. You need to fix this. And I think this is actually a valid point. What David was doing was not forgiving, and that's why when Joab comes and talks to him about it, David actually does end up forgiving Absalom and having a relationship with him again. Of course, this turns out bad in the long run because Absalom was sort of a lousy character, but I think it was a good example of how we can be forgiving but not actually forgiving. Here, David listened to Joab's whole sermon on forgiveness. Okay, I'll forgive him, but I won't forgive him. And that's something we have to watch out for. Sometimes we can sort of redefine a virtue to mean something that isn't it, and then be like, oh, well, I'm doing that thing. I'm doing that forgiveness thing. But you're not actually doing the forgiveness thing. You're doing something that kind of looks like maybe forgiveness if you don't peer too closely. And that's something I think we need to be careful of, because it's easy to say, oh, I'm doing that thing. But doing that thing involves actually doing it, not just saying, oh, that thing is happening. It's not the word forgiveness itself that matters. You could just as easily say something like pardon or affaissant or nuxi, which are forgiveness in different languages. But what makes a difference is not the word you're using, but what you're actually doing. You can call it nuxi if you want, but what matters is are you actually restoring your relationship with somebody? If you say forgiveness means, oh, what I do when I forgive someone is I kick that toxic person out of my life and then I don't ever think about them again. And that way I've forgiven them because they're not on my mind and I'm not resenting them. I'm just pretending they never existed. That's not forgiveness. You might feel better, but it's not what forgiveness is about. And you might think it's forgiveness, but it's not. And this is the sort of thing that Jesus rails on the Pharisees for in Matthew 23, where they redefine these words to mean something that they're not. So in Matthew 23, in verse 16, he's talking about swearing oaths. And he says, Matthew 23, verse 16, "Woe to you blind guides who say, if anyone swears by the temple, it is nothing. But if anyone swears by the gold of the temple, he is bound by his oath. You blind fools, for which is greater, the gold or the temple that has made the gold sacred? And you say, if anyone swears by the altar, it is nothing. But if anyone swears by the gift that is on the altar, he is bound by his oath." So what he's sort of referencing here is that in the Old Testament, there's a very clear law about keeping oaths. It says in Numbers 30, verse 2, "If a man vows a vow to the Lord or swears an oath to bind himself by a pledge, he shall not break his word. He shall do according to all that proceeds out of his mouth." But what he seems to be describing here in Matthew 23 is that the Pharisees had sort of figured out or made a law or found some sort of workaround to say, these sorts of oaths aren't really oaths. So if you swear this thing, well, you don't actually need to keep that. So you swore an oath, but you didn't actually swear an oath. That's a breakable oath. These oaths, the ones by like the gold of the temple or whatever, those are unbreakable oaths. You need to keep them. But if you're smart and only swear these oaths, then you can break them. And he's going, this is ridiculous. You're swearing an oath. And that's his whole point about when he goes on to say, "Whoso therefore shall swear by the altar, sweareth by it and by all things thereon. And whoso shall swear by the temple, sweareth by it and by him that dwelleth therein." He's saying, sure, you can find this legalistic reason why swearing by the temple is not actually swearing. But as far as anyone's concerned, if you're swearing, you're swearing. That's what you're doing. And redefining, oh, this is okay swearing, well, this is bad swearing. You're just redefining words to make yourself look righteous, but you're not actually being righteous. You're just redefining your way around what you should actually be doing. And it's actually interesting if you look. So I did some research on whether they still do this. I couldn't find anything on in terms of what you swear, but I did find it really interesting that on the Day of Atonement, they chant this thing that says, they chant it in Aramaic, and it actually sounds pretty cool. You can find like musical renditions of it. But basically what it means, according to Wikipedia, is "all vows we are likely to make, all oaths and pledges we are likely to take between this Yom Kippur and the next Yom Kippur, we publicly renounce. Let them all be relinquished and abandoned, null and void, neither firm nor established. Let our vows, pledges, and oaths be considered neither vows nor pledges nor oaths." So it's great. You just say this on Yom Kippur, and then if you make any vows or pledges or oaths during the year, well, they're not actually vows or pledges or oaths because you said back on Yom Kippur that they weren't. And yes, they actually do this, except that, like, a lot of people thought that this was a bad idea, and then governments were being like, so they created like new oaths that Jewish people would have to take that would be still be oaths, despite the fact that Jewish people said that oaths aren't oaths. And there is a whole bunch of legalistic stuff, which is what always happens when you read about Jewish laws. But I did find it amusing that they still have sort of these get out of oath free card that they have in Judaism nowadays. It's just a little bit different from the, oh, swear by this thing that doesn't matter. But yeah, people don't change that much. They had a legalistic workaround back then. They have a legalistic workaround now. And I think that's why it's really important to look at this sort of stuff, because people don't change. If this is what the Pharisees were doing back then, this is something we have to watch out for now, because we could be doing the same thing. And so when we have a word or something that we're using in a different way than you might expect, that's something to watch out for. For instance, something that Christadelphians are known for sometimes redefining in a nonsensical way is the word fellowship. If you look up the word fellowship in, say, Merriam-Webster's dictionary, you'll get something like this. Number one, companionship, company. Number two, community of interest, activity, feeling, or experience. The state of being a fellow or associate, a company of equals or friends. So basically this idea of being part of the same group or community or company or friendship or something like that. In some Christadelphian circles, though, you'll get a different definition of fellowship. You'll get fellowship defined as breaking bread with somebody. Hence, while the dictionary definition of a phrase like in fellowship would be to be companions or part of the same community, in some Christadelphian circles, in fellowship means legally allowed to break bread with each other on Sundays. Which is why you get interesting phrases, like there used to be sort of a joke. In America, Christadelphians are in fellowship 6 days of the week, but not on Sunday mornings. While in Australia, Christadelphians are in fellowship on Sunday mornings, but not the rest of the week. Which was this sort of clever comment about how the word fellowship was used in those two different places and talking about sort of the ecclesial situation. And so there's this, you can redefine fellowship as strictly the breaking of bread, but just because you redefine it that way doesn't actually make it true. It's true that breaking bread with somebody is a traditional way of showing companionship, and that today we still, if we're friends, if we're fellows, then we'll probably eat a meal together. And so it's all sort of related. But if you look at the way fellowship is used in the Bible, it's not strictly about breaking a bread. In fact, its definition in the Bible is pretty close to the dictionary definition of fellowship, which is probably why the translators translated it as fellowship rather than breaking bread. So if we look in 1 John 1, for instance, so this is in 1 John chapter 1. He talks about fellowship quite a lot. The word comes up a few times. And let me start reading from verse 1 of 1 John chapter 1. That which was from the beginning, which we have heard, which we have seen with our eyes, which we have looked upon and have touched with our hands concerning the word of life, the life was made manifest, and we have seen it and testified to it and proclaimed to you the eternal life which was with the Father and was made manifest to us. That which we have seen and heard, we proclaim also to you, so that you too may have fellowship with us. And indeed, our fellowship is with the Father and with his Son, Jesus Christ. And we are writing these things to you so that our joy may be complete. This is the message we have heard from him and proclaimed to you, that God is light and in him is no darkness at all. If we say we have fellowship with him, while we walk in darkness, we lie and do not practice the truth. But if we walk in the light as he is in the light, we have fellowship with one another, and the blood of Jesus, his Son, cleanses us from all sins. Now, I'll admit 1 John can be somewhat difficult to decipher sometimes. His wording kind of goes around in circles. But when he says, if we say we have fellowship with him while we walk in darkness, we lie, what he's not saying is that we need to be sitting down with the lights on when we break bread with Jesus. That's not what he's talking about when he's saying fellowship with him while we walk in darkness. No, it's not about, you know, not walking and having the lights on and breaking bread. What he's talking about is that, start from the beginning, he's saying that he came and the people with him and told people about Jesus so that they could have fellowship, so that they could be companions, both with him and with Jesus and God. Not just that they could break bread together, but that they could be part of a unified community, that they could be Christians together. And then he goes on to say that if you do evil things, then you aren't actually in fellowship with Jesus or God or John, because they don't do evil things, they do good things. That's the whole light and darkness analogy. If you do good things, though, then you're a companion of Jesus and God and John. You're in fellowship with them. And sure, this breaking of bread ceremony we do could be considered a symbol of fellowship. Companions do things like remember Jesus together, but it's more than that. If we break bread with each other each Sunday, but then attack or ignore each other the rest of the week, we're not really in fellowship. And that's sort of what he's bringing out in 1 John, that it's your actions that really make you in fellowship, not a ceremony that you do once a week. And so along the same lines, in 2 Corinthians 6, verse 14, this one's quoted a lot. Do not be unequally yoked with unbelievers. For what partnership has righteousness with lawlessness? Or what fellowship has light with darkness? Paul in 2 Corinthians 6 verse 14 is not saying here that light and darkness don't sit and break bread with each other. What he's saying is that they have nothing really to do with each other. They don't get along. They're not companions. They're not part of the same group. They're kind of polar opposites. He's not talking about the physical ceremony of breaking bread, because that makes no sense in the context of light and darkness. He's talking about the idea of being part of the same group. And in the same way, what Paul is saying is that we should avoid forming partnerships with people who don't believe the same as us. He's not saying, oh, it's okay to marry an atheist as long as you don't break bread with her, because that's the problem. No, he's saying that if you form a partnership with somebody who doesn't believe the same as you, whether it's a marriage partnership or whether it's a business partnership or something like that, it's going to be a problem, the same way that trying to mix light and darkness doesn't really work that well. Trying to mix righteousness with lawlessness doesn't work. Trying to form this sort of partnership when people don't agree is not going to work very well. And he's not talking about just a ceremony, he's talking about fellowship, the concept. So that's one thing where I've heard Christadelphians sort of mess up, is we can redefine the word fellowship to mean something that's a very, very specific case of what's a much larger, more abstract idea. And so that's something just sort of keep in mind whenever you hear something with a Christadelphian meaning, is, are we redefining this in a way that's not actually representative? Because that's what the Pharisees were doing. They would redefine things to mean something that wasn't actually it, and use this to legalistically work their way around things. And that doesn't mean all Christadelphianese is terrible or something like that. I don't think that when you say ecclesia to mean a Christadelphian church, that necessarily means that, oh, you're a Pharisee or something like that. It might still introduce confusion among people who don't know what an ecclesia is, but often it's a useful way to just differentiate between two different things. I'll also note that if you understand the Greek word ekklesia to mean Christadelphian church every time you read it in the New Testament, you're also going to be very confused. But I don't think it's a major source of hypocrisy. It can just be a source of confusion. However, there is one word that you have to be very careful how you say it. And this isn't just a Christadelphian thing. This isn't just like even a North American thing. This is a world thing. And the word that you have to be very careful with is the word love. If I say, I love you, what does that mean? And that's difficult. It can mean a lot of different things. And there has been much discussion on what I love you means. Quite a few pop songs, quite a few very late night phone calls, and of course, quite a few books have been written on the subject of what does I love you actually mean. In fact, there's this book by C.S. Lewis called The Four Loves, where he tries to take love and separate it into four different types of loves, and it's quite popular in Christian circles. Unfortunately for C.S. Lewis, while he does do a great job of separating out these four different types of love, and he tries to connect them all with different Greek words, actual Greek people don't follow what C.S. Lewis said in his book and kind of just use their words for love the same way we use our words for love, which is fairly ambiguously. In fact, if you go through most languages, they all have this problem where when you say you love somebody, it's not always clear. Do they mean they love me romantically? Does that mean they really like me? Is this sort of a family thing? Are we just really close friends? Because human beings actually like to sort of leave that one ambiguous a lot of the time. Most languages have a way of saying that unambiguously, but it's usually pretty awkward. So you just say you love, and then they sort of have to figure it out. It's kind of interesting. Like, this is a common problem, because it's a human problem. And people try to clear it up and use a specific word, but sometimes that makes things even harder. So in the King James Version, for instance, you may have noticed that in 1 Corinthians 13, it uses the word charity instead of love. And you may be like, why in the world is it using the word charity instead of love? When it's so if someone reads out of the King James Version, you get like, charity suffereth long and is kind, charity envieth not, charity vaunteth not itself, is not puffed up. Which is the word translated love everywhere else, and most newer translations will have love there. Why do they use charity? Because they were trying to clear up exactly what sense of the word love this was. This did not mean, by the way, back then, just giving to poor people. What charity was supposed to mean, it was a technical term for love to another human being as opposed to love towards God. So they were trying to say in this chapter, what he's talking about is showing love to other people as opposed to just showing love to God. Sure, but for most people, that was just confusing. So it's tough sometimes to figure out what words mean and how exactly to interpret things. Fortunately for us, though, Jesus also realized that these concepts were often difficult, and he gives us easier ways to understand this than to just try to always grok exactly what the word love means. Something I find really helpful is this definition of love, actually, that Jesus gives in Luke 6, verse 31. You've probably heard this a couple times before. Luke 6, verse 31. Jesus is talking actually about loving your enemy. And what he sort of sums that up with is, and as you wish that others would do to you, so do to them. In other words, the golden rule. So he's explaining this concept of what it means to love your enemies. And that's what he brings out. As you would that men should do you also to them likewise. And I find that's really helpful. Because as a definition of what does it mean to show love to someone, sometimes it can be really difficult. So if I love you, what does that mean? But this is easy. It's okay. What that means is I'm going to do for you what I would wish someone would do for me if I were in your position. And that always fits your current culture and situation and understanding because you're basing it on what you already know and sort of placing yourself in their shoes. If you're not sure what it means to love someone, at least according to the way Jesus is describing it here, do to them what you would have them do to you, and you're probably going to do pretty well. But sometimes that can still be a little abstract. So another thing Jesus did, which is really helpful for understanding love, is he provided an example. This is what he says in John 13, verse 34. He says, "A new commandment I give to you, that you love one another. Just as I have loved you, you also are to love one another." He doesn't just go, love one another. He also explains what he means by love one another. What do you mean by love? Treat one another the same way I treated you. Love one another as I have loved you. And so if we want to know how we're supposed to treat one another, how we're supposed to love one another, well, we look at how Jesus behaved towards his disciples. Or, as you may have heard it referred to, we WWJD. We ask ourselves, what would Jesus do? And then you look at his example and you do the same thing. And that's how we know we're doing what he said, because that's how he defined love. You love one another the same way I did. If we follow his example, we are doing what he commanded. And to be honest, these sort of strategies, these sort of do unto others as you would have them do unto you, and follow Jesus' example strategies, work with more things than just love. So, for instance, if we're wondering what actual Christian forgiveness looks like, as defined by Jesus Christ, probably the best place to look is at the example of Jesus Christ. How did Jesus behave around forgiveness? What did he teach about it? And he talks about it quite a lot in the Gospels, but my favorite one is in Luke 7, verses 36 through 50. So this is because it's both an example and a teaching. And my favorites are always when he both says it and he does it, and you see them both connect. So I'm going to read this passage because I think it's really good. This is Luke 7, verses 36 to 50. "One of the Pharisees asked him to eat with him, and he went into the Pharisee's house and took his place at the table. And behold, a woman of the city who was a sinner, when she learned that he was reclining at table in the Pharisee's house, brought an alabaster flask of ointment. And standing behind him at his feet, weeping, she began to wet his feet with her tears and wiped them with the hair on her head and kissed his feet and anointed them with the ointment. Now, when the Pharisee who had invited him saw this, he said to himself, 'If this man were a prophet, he would have known who and what sort of woman this is who is touching him, for she is a sinner.' And Jesus, answering, said to him, 'Simon, I have something to say to you.' And he answered, 'Say it, teacher.' A certain moneylender had two debtors. One owed 500 denarii and the other 50. When they could not pay, he canceled the debt of both. Now, which of them will love him more?" Simon answered, "The one, I suppose, for whom he canceled the larger debt?" And he said to him, "You have judged rightly." Then, turning toward the woman, he said to Simon, "Do you see this woman? I entered your house, and you gave me no water for my feet, but she has wet my feet with her tears and wiped them with her hair. You gave me no kiss, but from the time I came in, she has not ceased to kiss my feet. You did not anoint my head with oil, but she has anointed my feet with ointment. Therefore, I tell you, her sins, which are many, are forgiven, for she loved much. But he who is forgiven little, loves little." And he said to her, "Your sins are forgiven." Then those who were at the table with him began to say among themselves, "Who is this who even forgives sins?" And he said to the woman, "Your faith has saved you. Go in peace." This is an excellent example of what forgiveness means. Notice what Jesus does when he forgives this woman. He doesn't say, "Your sins are forgiven, but I'm not going to talk to you." No, he lets her touch him in a way that's kind of awkward, honestly. But he lets her touch him. He makes peace with her. He even defends her actions in front of others. It's ironic in some ways. The Pharisee was going, "Oh, if Jesus really was a prophet, he would know this woman was a sinner, and he wouldn't let him touch her, touch him, because he's not going to let a sinner like this touch him." But the thing is Jesus did know that she had been a sinner. But because he was the Son of God, this woman, when she touched Jesus, was not a sinner anymore. She'd been forgiven. So the Pharisee was wrong. This woman who was touching him was not a sinner. She had been forgiven. And because she'd been forgiven, she could touch Jesus. There was no division between them anymore. Unlike Mr. Collins' Christian forgiveness, where you forgive someone, but then you put this big, huge barrier between the two of you so that never the twain shall meet, Jesus' forgiveness creates a relationship. Jesus' forgiveness creates intimacy. Jesus' forgiveness removes barriers and brings people together. And so if we're confused about what Christian forgiveness means, or Christian love, or Christian honesty, or Christian grace, or Christian faith, or any of these sort of concepts, the best thing to do is look at the example of Jesus Christ, the one who logically Christianity is named after. If we want to know what Christianity is all about, look at the example of Jesus Christ. And I mean, that's why we're here this morning. It's why we come together every Sunday to read the Bible, hear somebody speak about it, and remember what Jesus did for us. Because it's by looking at Jesus's example, internalizing his example, that we can truly become like Christ, that we can truly become Christians. When we break bread, our fellowship is not just about eating a piece of bread together. It's about all being part of the same group, about being Christians, Christadelphians, brothers in Christ, not because we do a ceremony together, but because we think the same way and we act the same way, because we know the way that Jesus Christ thought and acted, and we follow in his footsteps ourselves. And so, as we come here together, remember what Jesus did, and think about, how can I do the same thing? If I'm faced with a decision, what would Jesus do? Because if we're like Jesus, then we will have fellowship with him, and we will be Christians, like he was.